and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Tim, dumb crime, stupid criminals. We got that up a little bit later on in today's program. For those of you that are subscribers, you'll get to hear that. If you're subscribing through Stitcher Premium, that is. If you are just a regular subscriber of Darkness Radio, you get our entire interview completely available right here as you're listening to it. For if you're interested in the dumb crime, stupid criminals aspect of the show, that's available only through the Stitcher Premium app. And that gives you all of our shows commercial free. It also gives you Darkness Radio commercial free and all of the hundreds of thousands of hours of audio that they make available through Stitcher Premium, all the other shows. So your $5 a month goes quite far in this podcast realm of Stitcher Premium. So remember, if you're thinking about signing up for it, you get commercial-free programming. You get the dumb crime, stupid criminals aspect of True Crime Tuesday. So you can't go wrong. It's a great little investment. If you've got an extra $5 a month, you're looking to sling around. Today, Tim, we're being joined by one of our favorite guests. She's back. She has a new book that'll be coming out hopefully right after the beginning of the new year. Put the Money in My Purse, A History of Female Bank Robbers. Judith Yates, our guest. Judith, welcome back.
Hey, guys. Thank you. I love this show.
Thank you. We love having you on here. And, you know, it's interesting because we've talked about female serial killers and female murderers and these crimes of passion. But you forget that there are quite a few female bank robbers and famous bank robbers at that, people that have done this. And, you know, I mean, obviously the first name that comes to mind for most people when you think of this is Bonnie and Clyde. But of course, you know, tied to Clyde Barrow, Bonnie sometimes took that back seat, but she was just as ruthless, if not even more ruthless, than Clyde himself, wasn't she?
Depending on who you talk to, that happens to be one of the cases that I know quite a bit about. And she actually never stepped foot in a bank. She actually never stepped foot in any of the places they robbed. She stayed in the car most of the time. She rarely was the getaway driver because, you know, Clyde could drive like a maniac. And most of the time she either stayed at the no-till motel or in the woods or in the car waiting for the guys to do their thing and come back. So she, you know, that she's maybe picked up a gun once. I know she picked up a gun a second time, and I think she shot herself in the foot or something, or near the foot. Anyway, nonetheless, she actually never robbed a bank. And I cover that in this book.
That's crazy, because when you think of Bonnie and Clyde, and the movie certainly made it seem that way with Warren Beatty and, oh my gosh, who played Bonnie?
Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway, that's right, Faye Dunaway. Mm-hmm. They certainly made her seem more integral. And I think, if I remember correctly, she injured her leg in a car accident, right? That's why she had that.
Yes.
And but she, you know, in a lot of the movies, they make it seem as though she was just as bloodthirsty and ruthless. As a matter of fact, I remember one of the scenes that they've kind of conveyed through many different iterations is her killing, I think it was a couple of cops out in the street.
She didn't do that.
No. So she just was hanging out with a bad boy and took half of the credit for the popularity of it all.
Right. And, you know, there hasn't been one movie made that is realistic about their crimes. That is 100% realistic. The one with Faye Dunaway and Beatty, negative. The newest one, I was so excited to see that coming out. I didn't
the
like
Highwayman?
The first 10 minutes. Oh, no, The Highwayman is very good. And, you know, I'm not a Costner fan, but I thought he did very well as in his role.
Tim, did but you see The Highwayman?
I believe I did. Yeah.
That was Woody Harrelson, Kevin Costner. It's a really interesting take because it's about these two former Texas Rangers that are brought in to try to figure out and corral Bonnie and Clyde. And it is so well done. But here is a movie really essentially about Bonnie and Clyde, and they're like third and fourth kind of characters. They're so kind of sidelined to the two investigators. And I don't even think they show them except for like their feet walking or, you know, over their shoulder or something. You never really get to see much of it, but that was a really amazing movie. And I'm not much of a Costner fan myself. Judith, but that one blew me away. It's on Netflix, I believe. So if you haven't had a chance to see it, it's the true story, reportedly the true story of the two highwaymen that were brought in to put together a team, kind of a version of the Untouchables, to stop Bonnie and Clyde in their escapades. And it was a powerful movie, well acted, well written.
It was.
Yeah. Beautifully done. But you don't think that was very realistic? Because I thought that was one where they showed Bonnie shooting the people in the street as well.
They did. And that's a common myth. She did not shoot those officers. That was a fellow that was running with them at the time. She was in the car. She had a rabbit. She was delivering a rabbit to her mother for Easter. She named it Sunny Boy. And she was in the car feeding Sunny Boy lettuce and carrots and such when those poor officers pulled up. And the tragedy is the officers never got a chance to pull their guns. And one of them was new to the force. So that is such a tragic story. And to add the impossible to it, you know. And again, I have not seen one movie that is true to their personalities or character, but I did enjoy that movie. I enjoyed it because it was from the law enforcement perspective.
Yeah, they really handled it in a beautiful way and created an interesting story on something that you thought you knew. They give you a different aspect and a different look. Now, as a criminologist, Judith, when you're examining these cases and going back into history to look at this, how do you cut the fact and fiction apart when that's what's believed to be true for so long? How do you end up proving or disproving some of these aspects?
Research, and some more. I was able to talk with some of the women who actually robbed the bank. This book took at least 4 years to write, and I gleaned every piece of research possible, old newspapers, musty court and police records. I interviewed the offenders, interviewed the investigators. I reviewed bank robbery footage. And I found out that when I was explaining to different people, you know, records clerks and people who are president of organizations and nonprofit and such, museums, when I explained to them what I was doing, they loved it. They jumped at the chance to assist me, which really, really helped. I'm so thankful for them. And I even had a few people, you know, email me after the book was turned in to my publisher. I got some more, you know, I got another picture. Hey, is the book ready? And I thanked them in this book who assisted me. But it was just a lot of research. And that's really, you know,
right,
what every book should be, what every true crime book should be. Now, not
like
every
in
bank
case,
robber is listed.
Well, that's what I was going to mention. In the case of like Bonnie Parker, though, where so much has been believed about her, written about her, and obviously from your point of view has been erroneous. How do you go back in and you know, especially on a case that's that old, and kind of sift through it and say, oh, well, this never happened at all. She wasn't there. This, were there actual accounts of this? Did Clyde Barrow and the other, you know, gang members own up to these shootings and these aspects, and the fact that Bonnie was more kind of the, you know, arm candy for Clyde and sitting in the car during these times?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, Bonnie's parents and Clyde even told her, turn yourself in. You'll probably get jail time, prison time, but you're going to meet your death if you stick with him, which of course she did. And they were kids. They were in their 20s, but I probably know more about the Bonnie and Clyde case and the Patricia Hearst SLA than I should. You know, I have read, written, researched, watched, talked to, interviewed people just on these two cases for years and years. So bottom line is Bonnie Parker herself never robbed a bank. And Clyde, actually, you know, he robbed banks, but not as often as he held up little mom and pop grocery stores, little out of the way places, which, you know, all his people and that part of the community just heralded him as kind of a Robin Hood, robbed from the rich. And that's not true. He was robbing people for the most part that were his type of family, just salt of the earth, you know, people trying to make a living.
Well, how, and that was interesting. You've got this guy, this couple that are really kind of treated almost like celebrities of their time. People would stop them, ask for their autographs, want photographs. You know, they protected Bonnie and Clyde. What was going on? Was it just because of the era, the depression, the everything that was going on, that it was just like anybody that kind of gave the middle finger to authority was just popularized by the masses that felt like they had been forgotten about? Was that part of it?
I think that was a lot of it, because we're talking about the Great Depression. We're talking about a huge line between the haves and the haves not. We're talking about people that are living in tents on the side of a river, you know, just outside of Dallas, that are watching people who have food to eat and clothes to wear and places to go, and they are not a part of it. And it was sort of like giving a finger to the quote unquote establishment, which in a way, so did the SLA and so did the robbers of the 60s, 70s. But nonetheless, they were made popular by just myths and legend, and even more so with the public after the original movie with Beatty and Farrell. You know, they become this icon. Even the clothes became
right
fashionable.
But I mean, during during the actual time, people were, you know, treating them very respectfully. They were thought to be cold-blooded killers, so I guess you want to be cautious how you deal with them. But it always astounded me. John Dillinger, kind of the same thing. You had these characters that were larger than life, and even though they were really villains, they were so well respected and liked by the general public. Or is that more kind of Hollywood spin because gangster movies were so popular?
In a way, because you have to, you know, people want an escape. They always want to escape. And especially during this time period, people wanted to escape their poverty, their struggles, just trying to survive day to day. And when you pick up a newspaper and read these headlines about these people, and at the time, law enforcement didn't have half the gunpowder that Clyde did, half the cars. Law enforcement was usually a guy who was, you know, given a gun and a badge and said, okay, you're the cop in these little towns. So he outran them. Now, these days, there is no way. Maybe a couple of, you know, 10, 12 years after the fact, probably no way. But Clyde knew automobiles, and he knew how to soup them up. He knew how to make them faster. And there was also a law at the time that if I do something bad in Tennessee and I cross the line into Kentucky, they have to stop at the line, at the state line. So he got away with a lot of things simply because he was clever, but he was also a good driver and a good shot against these, you know, small town officers who, you know, just said, okay, I guess I'm the cop. So, and it was an interesting time. It was an interesting time in history, and they mirrored those times. They mirrored these people. And of course you have the, I guess you want to call them the haves. And they said, you know, these are cold-blooded criminals. They're killing cops. They must be stopped. Whereas you've got this other population that's always being chased by the cops, or, you know, living literally hand to mouth, going, good for you. You made something. And we still have that today, if you think about it.
No, yeah, there's definitely still that aspect in our society. How is it, though, that, I mean, I could understand in the Wild West and even through the 20s, how robbing a bank would be a piece of cake. But even coming up through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, today people are still robbing banks. How is that a thing, Judith? How is there not, I mean, especially when people know there's those dye packs that are put in the bags, there are different things that happen. How do they not, you know, have found a way to just put a stop to banks overall, or bank robberies rather?
Well, you're never going to stop any kind of crime, no matter what you do. And men, I discovered, will most likely rob a bank to feed a habit. Women will rob a bank to feed a habit, or because of mental illness, or because, again, they're living hand to mouth. And the majority of females who have robbed a bank in the last, say, 10, 20 years, they did it to buy Pampers, milk for the baby, pay their bills. I asked one female who was still imprisoned, and I said, what did you do with the money? And she said, I paid two or three bills. Because the average take now in a bank robbery is only anywhere between $1,300 and $1,500. So think how fast that would go. If you've got the apartment, you've got a couple of kids, you've got nobody else to support you, you've got all of these bills going on, and that's what they will spend it on.
Mm. It's tragic that that's the point people break. They realize they feel like they have no other way to go but to rob a bank. And that becomes a federal offense as well, right? It's not just a stick up. It's not just a robbery, but a federal case because they're dealing with banks. Yeah. Sheesh.
And, you know, what really struck me again, and I had no sympathy for these people, because you're going up to somebody who's just trying to make a living. You're sticking a gun in their face, or you're telling them you have a gun. And the next thing you know, I think it would scare the hell out of most people. And all you have to do now to rob a bank is walk up with a note and, you know, this is a robbery, and bank personnel are trained how to handle these situations. They get their money and they're out. That's your average time to do this. You're usually caught on the third try. And I also noticed with women, they rarely wear disguises.
Really? So, Tim, valuable lesson. You can hold up two banks, but stop there, because the third one's where you're going to get caught.
Ah, right. Okay, I'll make a note.
You're only going to get about $2,500. I mean, what are you going to buy with that? You know, really, realistically.
That's around $2,000 more than radio show hosts make. So I think it's almost worth trying. That's crazy. But in you know, back in the 20s, 30s, even in the 1800s, when, you know, you're hearing about the old West stagecoach robberies and the bank robberies and such, I mean, they would get away with a pretty penny and sometimes with an entire payroll for a company or organization, right?
Oh, yeah, because, you know, you're talking about gang activity here. And you've got, you know, again, these poor guys that are just trying to make a living running a bank or driving the stagecoach or the train. And here comes, you know, 5, 10, 12 armed people pointing guns at you. You're going to do what they say. And especially trains. I mean, trains were easy. All you had to do was blow up the track and jump in the car and stick everybody up if you went that far, or take the money. And off you go into the Wild Wild West. And who's going to chase you, and how are they going to do it?
See, Tim, I'm pretty sure if we ever did past life and found out that we were bank robbers together, she makes it sound so matter of fact. You just have to blow up the track, pull it over, greet it. I'm pretty sure we would have blown each other up trying to do the rest of all of that. It's bonkers. And I'm out right now. I can't say what state I'm in, but filming a new TV series. And we're hearing about bank robberies and about train robberies. And you hear about just how prevalent this really was. It's kind of crazy that type of activity was commonplace, really. That had to be insanely hard for, you know, companies and businesses and bank systems to deal with, because I'm sure there wasn't the same type of insurance that there is today in protecting those kind of things.
Right. And it wasn't until 1934 that it actually became a federal crime to rob a national bank, state member bank, Federal Reserve. And again, you know, you have these guys who have the gunpowder, who have the careful planning, who have the group mentality, and they're going to take it and run. Look at Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, who ran the Wild Bunch, and nobody ever found out where their hideout was. Now, think of this, though. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of you know, untamed property and land and such. And there were actually two of the only females that knew where the hideout was for the Wild Bunch. I also discussed them and the myth and legends that kind of go around them. I didn't, you know, I focused on women who actually walked into the bank, not the women who waited in the cars, not the women who, you know, cashed the money for them, with a few exceptions.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Okay. I'm okay. I thought I've lost them. Oh no.
No. As I've explained, and I'll apologize again to listeners, I'm in a hotel room because I'm out on location filming. So from time to time, there are raucous noises that occur outside of my bedroom door here. I mute my microphone while there was a bunch of screaming and yelling going on out in the hall. So I apologize. But
where are you staying?
I wish I could tell you. No, it's just good people just not realizing there's somebody trying to do a radio show from a hotel room. How dare they?
I understand.
But you talked about Bonnie Parker, obviously one of the most famous and notorious non-bank robbing bank robbers, right? But you brought up the name Patty Hearst. And, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, that was such a big part of my childhood, hearing about Patty Hearst and everything that happened. But I don't think any of the generations after me are even aware of Patty Hearst or the story. So would you mind kind of taking us back and giving us kind of an outline of her story and what happened with her and the organization she was, abducted into?
Right. Patricia Hearst, that's a very interesting story. She came from, well, the Hearst Empire. And she was sort of flotsam. She was marrying a guy that, and she was kind of deciding who she was and where she was. I mean, she's, you know, in her 20s, and you know how you kind of think, okay, who am I and what am I going to do? And meanwhile, off to the side is this little raggedy tag group that's calling themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army, the SLA. And there's not even such a word as Symbionese, but you know, in their ignorance. And they decided, as did many people in the 70s that went this way, they're going to do it for the people. You know, for the people. They're going to make a statement, or they're going to gather enough money to survive for them to make their statement without, you know, even knowing what the poor people wanted. And usually they were very well educated. They were usually white. And they usually, you know, believed in these causes such as anti-Vietnam War, anti-government, because you have to think what's going on politically in the world. So they kidnap Patricia Hearst and they keep her captive. And then she, quote unquote, joins the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Now, Patricia Hearst, she was from a very famous and wealthy family, the Hearst family, right? And
oh, yeah. Was
that why she was specifically targeted, or did they not realize who they nabbed when they did it?
Oh, no. They had a whole list of people that they were going to scoop up, and Hearst was on. She was on that list. And they kidnapped her from her apartment, screaming and kicking in her bathrobe, threw her in the trunk and took off. And again, you know, kept her captive. And depending on who's telling the story, they said, do you want to join us? And she was scared for her life and said yes. Or it was the Stockholm syndrome and she said yes. Or, you know, she was just like, hey, let's see what's going on with this part of the world, and said yes, depending on who you talk to and, you know, how are we ever going to prove that? But so she joins the SLA, and altogether they robbed several banks there in the LA area, in the California area. Supposedly she took up with one of the members, and he and her were together as a couple. So they're, you know, robbing banks. They're doing this and that. Well, two of their main leaders get caught. Of course, everybody except Patricia and two other people die in this heinous fire with a shootout with the cops. And it was just, you know, okay, well, we've got nobody left but the three of us, and they didn't like Patty and she didn't like them. So they eventually joined up with another group and they robbed banks. Well, one person is heinously killed, and they were also, you know, there's this one splinter group that's saying, okay, well, we're going to bomb the pigs. We're going to bomb the cops, cop cars, cop stations. And the old SLA members are saying, well, you know, that's not our dig. So they're going back and forth. Patricia learned how to make pipe bombs. One of the guys from the SLA, he didn't know what he was doing, but he's one of those guys that always says he does. So he's making pipe bombs that could have just blown them all to kingdom come, because he's guessing. And eventually she is caught in an apartment, tried. Well, of course, it's a huge case. and it's a big financial name. And she gets thrown in prison. Well, all of her friends say, okay, this isn't right. Patricia, you know, was forced to join, blah, blah, blah. And the next thing you know, they're doing a fundraiser and they're appealing to all the political pals that they have to, you know, get her out of prison, which they do. And eventually her sentence was, oh God, what is the name?
But they kind of did time served for her, right? I mean, they just almost kind of forgave it, but acknowledged that she was a part of it and still did it.
Right. Yeah. Please cut all that out where I'm trying to get us. Yeah, they, you know, did time served. And then eventually, you know, her sentence was just kind of wiped off the board. Huh. And now she's showing dogs and, you know, living the life, and she's a grandmother. But it's an interesting story because it always comes down to, did she or didn't she willingly join the group? And the group was made up mostly of women. And very, very feminist women. Here they are following this fellow that's a prison escapee who has no idea what's really going on in the world. As a matter of fact, he couldn't even, you know, he was talking about everything was a coup for the group. Well, he would pronounce it coup. And you know,
the old coop. Yeah.
They're basically stringing together ideologists, you know, Marxism and such, and, you know, hippie thinking and anti-Vietnam, make love, not war. And they're stringing it all together, calling it a group.
Well, can you explain something for our listeners, right? Okay. So we hear this rich girl is kidnapped. She's kind of assimilated into this rebel crowd of ne'er-do-wells who are, you know, not quite as intelligent as they think they are. But after the shootout, after things like that, why is she still part of them? Why didn't she make a break for it and try to escape? Can you, you know, kind of give some insight to the listeners on that and why the courts were so willing to be forgiving to her?
Okay. One, again, who knows? It could be Stockholm syndrome. It could be fear for her life. It could be she was so into this group and the drama of it and the quote unquote fun of it. And it's absolute freedom. There are no restraints. It just depends on who you talk to. Now,
right.
Why was she, you know, forgiven? Why was she time served? Money, money, money.
Right. Fame and wealth and power helped get her that freedom again.
Oh, yeah. The Hearst family was so well connected with politics, obviously. And she was huge news. It was a huge case.
Right.
And, you know, the power of celebrity, the cult of personality, so to speak.
Do you believe if it was Paul Hearst, you know, a man that would have been in? Do you think there would have been the same level of forgiveness, or was it again because of the time, the era, this poor woman, what she had to endure with this, and for listeners, Stockholm syndrome, where you kind of start to identify with your captors and almost feel like you become part of them, right?
No, it was a whole different cat. If it would have been
right.
A male,
yeah,
no,
yeah,
yeah, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book is because, you know, this is such a interesting crime and its dynamics. And what I did with it is I would first discuss the history and the dynamics and the social and the socioeconomic, what was going on with women during this time period. It's broken up into time periods, you know, from the 1800s to modern.
Right.
And so in the 70s, I mean, you think about it, you had Women's Lib. You had women coming out of the house, going into the workforce, bra burning, anti-Vietnam, the whole nine yards, you know, drugs and rock and roll. And so you had this whole show going on, per se, in the country. And you were either a dove, you know, or you were a hawk, and off you go. It was just, and you know, people were taking off from home and quitting everything and going cross country to go to, you know, all these different places in the world to find themselves. And it was just such a different time.
We'll take a quick break. Again, the book is called Put the Money in My Purse, A History of Female Bank Robbers. Our guest, Judith A. Yates. We will have a link for that book when it's available. You can find it at darknessradio.com under the store tab. Check out our Amazon storefront. You'll see all of the best in paranormal books, all of the best of true crime books, and some cool gift items and swag that you can pick up year round. It's all right there. Just go to darknessradio.com, click on the store tab. All right, Judith, in examining these stories, what is the oldest story that you were able to uncover? From what year did you find a female bank robber?
Okay, well, the first time a female robbed a bank that was recorded was 1897. Her name was Cora Hart. And I tried to keep the book focused on women who actually walked into the bank and held up a weapon or, you know, brandished a note. But with Cora Hart, it was the first recorded, and I thought her story was very interesting, so I included that.
Well, give us some background on the story, please.
Okay, well, Cora Hart was born in this hard scrabble family, you know, and again, you have to think of the times, the 1800s, and she was very enamored with the outlaws that were, and of course, again, they were, you know, they made the press, they were the news, they were the bad boys. And so Cora grew up in this hard scrabble life on the prairie. She married, and here they are living hand to mouth, trying to eke out a living from the soil. And a friend says, well, you know where the big money is, and we could just, you know, leave this dirt farm and do whatever we wanted. Well, they all get together with her brother and her husband and Cora. And as they're planning it, Bud is sort of, her husband Bud is sort of, well, I don't know. So they finally get it together. They're ready to ride. And Bud says, I'm not going with you. And Cora tells him, I will not live with a damn coward. Well, she chops her hair off. She puts men's clothes on, which at the time was very taboo. And off they go. And they rob this bank. She stays outside holding onto the horses. They trusted her for that. They ride off into the sunset, and the next thing you know, here comes a posse. At one point, they're shooting it out, shooting one another and you know, into the brush and scrub to get away. She even saves another fellow's life, and they get caught because, as usual with bank robberies, somebody made a stupid mistake. The fellow who was carrying their map, where they're coming from and where they're going, he drops the map.
So there's a posse.
Listen, I got stories that people did that were there. I know they're going to make dumb criminals. I know they already have. But nonetheless, so they rob the bank and they get caught at her father's house, which happens a lot. And she stands trial, and she was the newspaper darling because she was a female bank robber who dressed as a man. And the way they physically described her, which is always included, you know, with these newspapers, how unattractive she was, how foul-mouthed. And, of course, they just expanded the story. She's a crack shot, and she can, you know, ride a horse backwards and shoot your eye out at a mile. I mean, they really pumped her up. And she goes to prison, comes out, and as far as everybody knows, leads this crime-free life. But she was an interesting character because she was, you know, quite mouthy, and she would, like she told Bud, you know, I'm not going to live with a damn coward. I'm going to do what I want. And then when she was interviewed by the newspapers, and she says, you know what? I would have robbed the whole town if I could have. I would have shot them all up. And she was, you know, kind of a smart ass. And they described her as slovenly, of lowly origin, not at all attractive in any way. You know, and this is where, you know, they said, well, were you scared during the robbery? Because she's a female. And she says, not one damn bit. So she's pretty smart mouth with this press. And they ate it up because she was just, you know, what a woman wasn't supposed to be.
That's, you know, I love when you hear back into these stories and how it shakes the paradigm of what society expected and the woman being so powerful and strong-willed in doing this. And, you know, you don't realize that just because they're not holding up banks, they were the ones holding families together. They were the ones plowing fields and taking care of their family and working on the side. And, you know, then we look at them and there was this whole concept of women are these genteel, gentle little flowers. And really, in many ways, they were much more powerful and strong than the men that were their contemporaries.
In a lot of ways. And they even said in newspapers, her features are coarse and masculine, as are her tastes, which I thought was very interesting because she, you know, is supposedly boozing it up and fist fighting and riding horses and shooting guns. And she did ride horses. She did shoot guns. She lived on the prairie, you know, and it was interesting. They called her the newest of new women right up to date, fearless, dogged, and desperate. Short black hair, you know, and again, dressed like a man. They really, really focused on that.
Crazy. Well, what, you know, and that was the oldest one you were able to uncover, correct?
Yes.
Now, what is the youngest female bank robber that you were able to find when researching for the book?
Oh, barely a teenager. And they got away.
They got away with it. So how did they know who it was then?
The bank teller described them, and bank tellers are taught so many interesting things as to, you know, how to describe a robber as far as height, weight, face. And there is some video. It's very scratchy because of the cameras and the quality. But nonetheless, she said that she thought they were maybe 12, 14, 13, somewhere in there. And they walked into the bank, they handed over a badly spilled note, and they left with the money and just literally disappeared.
That's amazing. Well, those were small communities and such, weren't they? How did they not know who these kids were?
Well, there's a big apartment complex down the road from this bank. And story has it that their father or stepfather talked them into doing it. So it's, you know, it's possible they just kind of disappeared into the woodwork of the apartment complex. And the officers even went far enough to go to the local schools and ask for handwriting samples from the girls that matched the description. Still couldn't match it. Of course, the statute of limitations has either run out or is about to run out. So these girls basically got away with it. Now, they did ask two girls who matched descriptions in the apartment complex. And they said, oh, no, we were playing Monopoly. We don't know anything about that. Well, you know, were they playing Monopoly with Monopoly money or, you know, actual dollars? But nonetheless, they never actually, you know, they never caught these kids.
And now digging through again, you see some of these stories and obviously understand tough times and why people are doing this. Were you finding any of these characters to be kind of redeeming in their qualities of why they did this? Was there any of this Robin Hood concept, this romanticized version of why people were stealing? Were they trying to help their community, trying to help others, or was it mostly for selfish reasons?
No, I never advocate for any criminal and why they did what they did, because we all have the choice, and that is just my belief. However, there were some that bothered me in a different way. And one was named Hannah Sabata. She was known as Bank Robber Chick. She robbed the bank and then she went home, smoked some weed, got on YouTube and made a video of herself brandishing the money and the weed and the car she stole. She jangled the keys and she's doing all of this playing Green Day in the background. It made huge news. She made front pages and the news and all of that about being stupid and, you know, not playing with a full deck. Well, Hannah is severely mentally ill. And she is in prison now. What's interesting is Hannah is a wonderful artist. She draws and paints these strange, interesting pictures. But she's writing a book, which she sent me. But she has such a quirky, different outlook on life as a researcher, as a female, as a criminologist. I find her to be probably one of the most interesting cases, just because reading what she's writing and listening to her, it's interesting how her mindset is set from both a background and from the mental illness and from the previous drug abuse, which I believe she was self-medicating.
Mm. Tragic, huh? Just to see the way these lives unfold. What was, we talked about quite a myriad, but who was the oldest bank robber that that you were able to locate?
Oh, that's an interesting story. She was in her 80s, and she walked into a bank to withdraw some of her money. Excuse me, she rolled into the bank because she used a walker. And when she got home, she thought they had shorted her. So she went back to the bank and said, you know, hey, you've shorted me. I think it was $200. And so they did their research and they were like, no, ma'am, you know, you weren't shorted. Well, words were exchanged. And the next thing you know, this 80-something-year-old woman is pulling a gun out of her little pocket thing that she keeps on her wheelchair. I mean, I'm sorry, on her walker, and is waving this gun around. You're going to give me my money. And it was unloaded, but who knew that? You know, who stops to look? And the bullets were in another, you know, another pocket. And she was arrested and charged for bank robbery and a string of other offenses. But when the police escorted her out, she's in her walker giving everyone the stink eye. And it's just an interesting story how, you know, she's thinking, okay, well, they shorted me, I'll show them, without any heed to, oh, and by the way, I'm throwing a gun around in a bank.
Right.
And, you know, there were witnesses, so they're ducking. And one witness even said, okay, well, so what if it was unloaded? We still had a gun pointed at us.
Right. Exactly.
She was pissed, you know, she was mad. So it's an interesting story.
Did they go relatively easy on her? Again, because of her age and what was going on, or did they throw the book at her?
No, they went easy on her. You know, if you look at things in retrospect, you're not going to get that many years for bank robbery unless you brandish a weapon. And people know that. They know their business. They research this stuff. I had somebody ask me, well, don't you think you're telling people how to rob a bank? No, because everything I'm telling my reader, these guys and these women already know.
Right. It's funny, but you think that. But, you know, we do this segment on the show every week called Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. And through the years, we've talked about bank robbers who've gone in and they'll wear a mask up to the counter and ask for money. And the person behind the counter goes, I'm sorry, I can't hear you through the mask. And these idiots will take their mask off, ask for the money, put the mask back on, and now their face is on camera. So it's, you know, we think that these criminals sometimes are a little smarter than they are. And oftentimes we're proven that they're just morons who, you know, watched one too many Jesse James movies and decided that this was something they were going to give a shot to. So bizarre. Well, and speaking of bizarre, what were some of the more unusual cases that you cover in the book? And we do, folks, we do have a link so you could pre-order the book, and it's on today's show guide. So if you click that, it'll take you to the page. You can pre-order the book. So when it does become available, you'll be the first to get your hands on it.
I found several things interesting. The first recorded bank robbery caught on tape, one of them was a female. And then there's the one-armed bandit brandishing a steak knife, demanding money. And when they told her no, she ran out. The female twins that decided they were going to rob a bank, but they didn't have a license because they weren't old enough, so their mother drove them to the bank. And Etta Place, also known as Etta Pace, who ran with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, I found her very interesting. She is so much is known of Butch and Sundance, but not a lot about Etta, and she was right there by their side. It took some time to write, and the stories of these women are so interesting in so many different ways. You see mental illness, you see, oh, you know, desperation, or you see it because I love the man and he said, let's do this. And I said, okay. And there are two former strippers who they were all sitting around and one of them said, I don't feel like going to work today. And somebody said, me neither. And the man said, you know what we should do? And off they went. So there's just this plethora of different stories.
Well, can I ask strippers, you real quickly? I want to get back to the strippers, which sounds horrible saying it out loud. But you mentioned earlier the one woman who went in and said, you know, this is a stick up. And they said no. And she left. Can she still be arrested for just doing that, even though she didn't get the money and she, you know, nobody was harmed? I don't know what the laws
definitely.
Are considering that. Okay. So
yes,
joking, if I went into the bank, even though I'm not brandishing a weapon and did my transaction, she said, is there anything else I can help you with? And I said, yeah, this is a stick up. Even though I'm kind of joking, is that still considered a crime?
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, bud. We're going to have to send you commissary money and someone's going to have to pay your bill.
You know what though? Three meals and a roof over my head. It doesn't sound like such a bad deal at my age.
Listen, prison and jail food are nasty. I worked at both and you know, you don't want to eat off the plate and the company is not good. You know, it's a bunch of obnoxious 14-year-olds when people get behind bars.
Judith, I'm the father of 11. I'm pretty sure I'm used to that kind of behavior at home anyway. So I think it's going to be a resort for me at this point. Tim,
yes,
now you know my
surrounded
retirement
by 1,200
plans.
Of them.
Yeah, exactly. Then I could just let my inner young Dave back out again and not have to be the bad guy. What a weird set of stories, though. So did the woman get arrested that walked out after being told no, she couldn't have the money?
Oh, the one-armed bandit? Yes.
Yeah.
She was arrested and she went without incident and there was a trial, obviously, and a hearing, and she was adjudicated to drug rehab. So I think, you know, that was probably a lot of it is just the desperation. I had several cases like that, and a very famous rapper's mother robbed at least two banks.
No. All right,
yep.
Fill us in, and then we'll get back to the strippers.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave that as a mystery up to my readers, but she robbed several banks because even though he was just a millionaire, she was destitute. There were a lot of issues with him growing up, a lot of discord. And she was sort of just left on her own devices and being financially strapped. She tried to rob a place where they sell, you know, hair goods, the dye and the everything else, the beauty goods. And she didn't get away with that. Well, she gets out of jail and robs another bank. And anyway, she robs a second bank, but no disguise, very calmly, and of course, caught on video in living color and in black and white, and she gets arrested.
Unbelievable. And this is a famous rapper that everyone would recognize if we said the name?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, you'll have to get the book to read the full story on that, folks. Now, because I know Tim's very mad at me for stopping the story, let's go back to the stripper heist.
Everybody wants to know about the stripper heist.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Actually, okay, I'm going to interject here. There was also a guy who was a pimp, and he decided there wasn't much money involved, so he started having his prostitutes rob banks. And pretty soon, people are showing up at his door going, I want to rob a bank. So instead of his little ring of prostitutes, he had a ring of bank robbers. And he was driving them to and from with an ankle bracelet on. He was monitored because he was on parole.
Jeez. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Is that how they figured out who it was? Because they realized that this ankle bracelet was always within a block of the crime?
That was part of it. That's part of how he got in trouble.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
He was a winner, but yeah, they were knocking on the door saying, "Hey, I want to rob a bank too," you know, because it was better than working the street. It was more lucrative, and you know, it became like a hobby, like fun to these girls, these women. And one of them, she was young; it was her first time to do anything "quote unquote" this bad. So one of them says, "Okay, look, here's the cell phone. I'm going to walk you through it. Okay, walk in." Okay, tell the teller. I mean, she literally walked her through the robbery. And the girl's on the cell phone going, okay, okay, I'm here. What do I say? Okay, hold on. This is a robbery. Give me all your money. Okay, now what do I do? I mean, that's exactly how it ran. But let's go on with strippers. These two little chickadees, they were dancing at a club, and they called them the Barbie Bandits.
All right.
And they were, you know, kind of those pretty, pretty blonde girls, and they decided, okay, we're going to...
Did they make a movie about this?
They could make a movie about every woman in this book.
No, I know, but I think there wasn't there a movie like starring Mina Savari? It was a bunch of pretty little cheerleaders that end up holding up a bank. It sounds like you're kind of detailing that, although they were cheerleaders, not prostitutes. So, you know.
Well, it might have been because, kind of you know, art imitates life and life imitates art. So, it, you know, it could have been drawn from all of the above.
Crazy. All right. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead. They decide.
Oh, okay. The strippers.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they decide it's more lucrative than, you know, dancing on a pole. So, they have a guy and he says, hey, listen, I know a guy that works at this bank and he's a teller. And if he gets a cut, he'll be part of this. Okay, fine. So the women, of course, the man sends out the women and they're giggling and looking at themselves in the mirror and talking. And they go to the bank and they're looking around and they call the guy. Okay, where are you? He says, you're at the wrong bank. Oh,
jeez.
So they get back in the car giggling about how silly they are. And they go and they get on camera robbing the bank. And it's obvious he's part of it the way he's shelling out the money. And they leave and they go to the mall and they get their hair done. And they just, you know, one buys a TV at Walmart. I mean, they're just buying and doing, and they get caught on camera. And of course, it goes all over the place, goes national. Do you know these women? And people were calling in saying it's Nicole Richie and
what?
Paris Hilton.
Oh my God. And it didn't work.
Well, the manager,
you're still free.
Not much. Not much. But the owner of the strip bar calls and he says, I know those girls, you know, and he gave their stage names. And of course, that was, you know, all was said and done. But it's interesting because one of them is supposed to be on the straight and narrow now, but she talks about it so nonchalantly and you can tell she likes being on camera. And now she's a good girl and knows Jesus and goes to church and stays out of trouble. Well, if you look up her profile on Facebook, she's now working at Hooters and taking, you know, 110 selfies of herself. And it's an interesting story. Now, the other one, she can't stay out of jail. And she was also using drugs quite often, as, you know, drugs in that business of stripping and dancing usually go hand in hand. So there she is getting in and out of trouble. And the other girl, you know, she's completely innocent and being a good girl. So it's interesting, though, that it was also nonchalant and cute and funny to them. But I have a feeling that life to them is cute and funny because they're pretty and they can, you know. Now, in their mugshots, not so much.
No.
But, you know.
Well, Tim, just remember, when we decide to finally hold up a bank, we just have to look really pretty and we might get off a little easier.
Well, looks like I'm getting caught.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly worth examining. Crazy stuff. Judith Yates, it's always a pleasure catching up with you. The book, again, we have a link for it in today's program guide, Put the Money in My Purse, A History of Female Bank Robbers. And you could pre-order the book. It'll be out sometime early, hopefully 2022. But go pre-order it now so that you can get your copy and read it along. And this is one of those great books that you can read a story, set it down, come back to it, read the next story. This is good bathroom material. That's what I refer to it as.
Hey,
no, that's a plus. No, it's a plus. I trust me. I'm working on my own paranormal book where it's short stories about real paranormal experiences. And it's called Stories to Scare the Shit Out of You, The Perfect Bathroom Reader. That's what I like about it. So no, it's great that these stories are concise and short. See? And it's perfect for that. So thank you very much, Judith. And keep in touch with us as more books come out. And we'd love to hear from you again.
Thank you. Love to hear from you, too. You guys be safe out there.
Will do. Thank you. All right, folks. You heard about it right here. Now you understand that there are ramifications, no matter how pretty and popular you are for holding up banks. So think twice. And if you do it, make sure to cut Tim and I for 10% apiece. All right, we're going to kick open the case files because just like us, it's time to look at dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's crayon news story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to be upfront about this, Tim, with dumb crime, stupid criminals.
Sure.
I'm keeping the last two stories last. They're horrible. They're so gross. So gross. So I'm putting that out there. We're going to work our way through to the last two. And if you have a weak stomach or are easily grossed out, you don't want to hear these last two stories. But they're horrific. Oh. They're definitely dumb crimes, definitely stupid criminals, and they're completely horrific. So I'm just giving that fair warning.
All right.
Your old pal Dave's watching out for you.
Well, that's good. Does that mean I get to bow out for the last two stories, all things considered?
Yeah. No, you're stuck listening, man. That's part of being a host with me. Yeah.
I better get a bucket then.
All right. Let's start off simple.
Mm-hmm.
A man kept calling 911 to report he was tired, Tim.
Aw.
I've had those days.
Yeah, me too.
I've had those days. I don't know that I'd ever call 911, but an Indiana man repeatedly called 911 to inform police operators that he's tired and he's going to spend the next 2 months resting up in county jail, according to court records. Daniel Schroeder, I'm going to say Schroeder, could be Schrader, but I don't want to take any ownership.
Okay.
61 was arrested Tuesday night at his Evansville home. That's four for people that are not sure what that means, Tim. A quartet of calls placed that evening to the police emergency line. The male caller kept calling in, stating that he's just probably not tired, Tim. T-A-R-D, tired, that he needed some sleep.
Right.
Schroeder's calls about his weariness came a day after he pleaded guilty to a prior misuse of the 911 system. In the earlier case, he copped to calling the police to report that he was upset what a female relative was not following his rules. A judge ordered that Schroeder serve 6 months in jail, but suspended imposition of the sentence on the condition that he does not call 911 unless it is an emergency. Schroeder violated that agreement the following day, prompting prosecutors to file a motion seeking the revocation of his suspended sentence. Schroeder pleaded guilty Wednesday to his most recent unlawful use of 911. He was sentenced to 60 days in the Vandenberg County Jail on the misdemeanor charge. His sentence in the original case was amended to 60 days behind bars to run concurrently with this latter case. Schroeder's rap sheet includes four convictions while driving intoxicated, as well as convictions for narcotics possession and leaving the scene of an accident, Tim.
You know, it confounds and astounds me, Dave, as to why people continue to use the 911 emergency number for such casual things. I mean, we've heard everything from, they got my burger order wrong, to I need something picked up at the store, to now I'm just plain tired. What part did you not miss in grade school when they said 911 means emergency only?
Yeah, but you know what, Tim? They also heard 911 as a joke, and that played more on the radio than I ever heard 911 is only for an emergency.
Well, I mean, that was a parody song. If you believed a parody song.
Yeah, well,
you know,
think about who we're talking about, Tim. A world full of dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
Yeah.
So that's going on. Let me see here. You know, I do want to mention, this isn't really a crime, Tim, but I feel as though it's kind of a crime.
Okay.
So, you know, I have friends that are in the many different industries, and Jamie Kaler, the comedian, has released a new comedy album called Homeschooled. You can find it on iTunes, and I actually listened to it on Audible. It's a great comedy album, very funny. And he released a video clip on the social media.
Mm-hmm.
So I shared that video clip on the social media, Tim, but there's one small problem.
Sure.
when you share it, it puts up a screen capture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a screen capture of my friend Jamie Kaler with his microphone to his mouth. It's a profile view of him. And it just happens to correlate with part of his story. So there's a closed caption on the screen, and it says, during the pandemic, one of my buddies had a stroke.
Oh, so no.
I'm receiving many messages of people praying for Jamie Kaler, and it to Jamie. I'm like, buddy, you're going to start feeling a lot better. And he goes, I'm not feeling bad. And I go, well, you'll start feeling even better then, because the clip I tried to share shows just that line, during the pandemic, one of my buddies had a stroke. So it's part of his comedy routine. And I know you're thinking, Dave, that's not funny. If you listen to it, you'll understand the comedy behind it. But yeah, so if you see that video, folks, on my Instagram, just click the video so you can actually watch it and you'll hear the deal. But I do thank all of the great prayer warriors out there that I just feel like it's a crime that I posted a comedy video and people are mistaking it for for that. You know, the other weird thing, I you know what I had sent to me recently?
What's that?
An image of Prince dead in the elevator. Did you know that there was a picture taken?
Yeah, I've known about it and actually saw it a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, I didn't really want to see it, but it kind of popped up. Actually, TMZ first had that picture a couple of years ago. They only posted it for a short time. I think they've probably taken it down by now. But yeah, it's been out there for a while.
It's, you know, I'll tell you, it's pretty nondescript. I wasn't even sure if it was real. It just shows Prince laying on the ground. His eyes are closed. You know, there's no vomit. There's nothing that would look out of the ordinary. It just looks like he was laying down. Mm-hmm. But somebody, you can actually see in the mirror reflection, you can see somebody somebody heavyset standing there taking the picture.
Yeah.
So, you know, tragic. But I didn't know that. I didn't know if that was a real picture or one it of those is. Kind of national, because it's got the National Enquirer watermark on it.
Oh, okay. Well, then that's the source that chose to
right.
publish it. Yeah, the original was it Hennepin County or Scott County? Is that I'm not sure which county, but the original county that released the coroner had actually they hadn't released the death photo. Mm-hmm. It was available, I think, for closed sources, and one of those sources let the death photo out. So yeah, and it's kind of ghoulish. It's one of those things where, you know, you don't consciously want to go see it. It especially if you're a Prince fan.
Well, I will say this though: if you stumble upon it, it's pretty tame. I remember finding an article I was reading about Chris Farley's last night. And this was a couple years ago. And then at the bottom of the article, there's the photograph of him dead with vomit and bile all over his face. And and I was not prepared for that. That was one of those. And I've seen some other tragic death scene photographs. And this was very tame. So if you do stumble upon it, it's not real mentally scarring, but it is jarring still. You're like, oh, shit, that's out there.
Right. Well, and it's the thought that and really, I think you have to. You have to think of it more from a moral, psychological standpoint. You're seeing somebody, you are seeing just a shell of somebody, but you're seeing somebody who basically went through their last moments. And, you know, that the picture wasn't taken too long after he was discovered. So, mm-hmm. You know, the fact of the matter is it's still a bit ghoulish. I mean, you know,
there's a lot of people out there. There's websites dedicated to death shots post-mortem photography. So there is that ghoulishness of people's interest of wanting to see. And sometimes it's also a, what's the word I'm looking for? It's closure for some people because you just can't wrap your head around the fact that they're gone.
It is. You know? It doesn't really intersect with something else that kind of bothers me, but it's the same thing. I don't, mm-hmm. when there's open caskets at funerals, I've seen some people take pictures of the deceased. I don't get that.
No, I know when we were at my grandfather's funeral, my Aunt Kit, his sister-in-law, she took pictures at every funeral of family members. So there are pictures of my grandfather in his coffin that I don't want to see. And I don't get it. But, you know, there's a lot of famous photographs out there. I will admit I am fascinated by some of them, like Bela Lugosi.
Mm-hmm.
He was buried in his full Dracula costume. Metal and all, and you can find that picture online, and it's quite chilling because he looks lifelike in the picture. You know, the makeup artist that did his work was pretty compelling, and considering he was in his late 70s, I think, when he passed away, that's an interesting image to see. But he was truly buried in his Dracula costume. But there are quite a few of those that show up, and like I said, I'm interested, and I read about a lot of these celebrities in their last moments or days, just because I'm curious of what happened, where did things go off the rails, and who was with them, why didn't they see something? And it's amazing to see sometimes, you know, like John Belushi, how many damn celebrities were with him, around him that last night, and you know, Robin Williams, I think the last one. And yeah, I found that, you know, there's the image of Robin Williams too, after his, suicide that exists out there. That's very disturbing. So, very strange stuff. You know, it's not my forte. Like I said, the Dracula one, I was fascinated by Lincoln because I think they had dug him up years later for something, and they realized that there was nothing wrong with his body. All that was out of place was a little mold on his tie. So that story fascinated me just because they dug him up. And then there's the story of the bride in Chicago, who she died, I think, during childbirth, mm-hmm. and was buried along with the baby. And there's an actual statue of her in her bridal gown, and she was buried in this bridal gown. And you can find the story. It's pretty compelling. As a matter of fact, they snapped a picture of it when they opened her coffin like 10 years later to get a family, a very valuable family heirloom out of the coffin, I believe was the story.
Okay.
And it's been a while since I've read it, but she is completely pristine. It's eerie how pristine she is. And then the baby was gone.
Weird.
Yeah. So, I mean, it had been there, but it had completely decayed and fallen apart where she did not. Then there's the famous story of that mannequin in Mexico, I want to say it is, or Venezuela. It's some crazy ass place where there's a mannequin in the window and they believe it's the former owner's daughter.
Yes, and I remember that one. Yeah, yeah.
That's it. You can look at the photographs, folks. There's no way this thing is a mannequin. This is definitely, and they only dress it behind a curtain, you know, I think this is like the second or third owner since the original owner, but they've kept this mannequin there. It's creepy as hell. But it's like some of those interest me just because of the stories involved in them, but
sure,
I don't like when I'm skipping around and, you know, somebody here sends me this picture of Prince dead in an elevator. I'm like, what the shit?
Yeah.
Again, thankfully it's not a real disturbing photograph. It's just more disarming because, you know, I wasn't expecting to see a picture of Prince dead.
Well, I think you have to take every circumstance into account when you're thinking of it too. You think of Prince as a guy who was so full of life.
Yeah.
And was in his later years very giving. I mean, he would give to different charities without wanting acknowledgement. So here's a guy who really was out there and forward and involved in stuff at the end of his life, yet was still struggling with a drug problem having to do with pain issues. And the way he went was very unfortunate. You know, and then to just put the picture out there, it's just a kind of a 180 slap in the face that you just go, you know, I don't want to remember him like that. That's not how I want to remember him. I have my way I want to remember him. People have their way they want to remember him. I don't know why you'd want to remember him falling near an elevator at Paisley Park. I don't know.
Let me tell people too, just do me a favor. Don't send me death pictures of anybody unless there's like a fascinating ghost image in it. Like if you see, you know, an image of somebody and, you know, you obviously see what looks like their soul escaping, or, you know, those are interesting to me. Like that, there's that photo from the car accident where they show the person on the stretcher and you see this ghost-like image going up from it.
Yeah.
That's kind of compelling and weird. But, you know, for the most part, don't send me pictures of dead people or dead celebrities. I don't want to see them unless you hear me specifically say, you know, boy, I wish I could see a picture of this celebrity dead, which I don't think you'll ever hear me say.
No.
Yeah, it's very strange.
There, you know, you mentioned that type of photography, and we have early shows from, I think it was 2006 or 2007 with Bobby mm-hmm. Sullivan.
Right.
Yeah, and he had, I think he had a couple of those photos, didn't he, of
could be
spirits I know and there's car a, accidents and stuff yeah. like that.
And there's that famous one with the I think it was from Minnesota, wasn't it? The kids that were on their way to a hockey tournament.
Yes. Yeah.
And died in a car accident. And when the police were there taking photographs, they caught a very disturbing photograph
yeah.
of the boy. You see him slumped over in the front seat, but you see an image of him standing outside the car screaming. It's yeah. heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
So I've seen photographs like that. And I know that there's post-mortem photographs, but yeah, just, you know, it's probably not a crime to send me those pictures, but don't send them to me. I don't want to see them.
Yeah.
It's that's weird. So unless I specifically ask for somebody's picture dead, I don't see that ever happening. Please don't send them to me. Thank you. Anyway, let's get back to more pressing stories like this sure. one, Tim. Tim. I don't know why I said you like this.
Because in Spanish, my name is Timoteo. So there you go.
Timoteo. Meet Isaiah Kirby, if you would, Tim. Mm-hmm. Following his arrest early last week, the South Carolinian, is that how you say it? South Carolinian.
Carolinian.
Was charged Friday with two counts of attempted murder, narcotics possession, and possession of a weapon during a violent crime, according to court records. But that's not what the focus is of this article, Tim.
Okay.
Kirby is being held in the Spartanburg County Jail on $55,000 bond in connection with four felony counts. The teenager resides in Cowpens, a small town outside of Spartanburg. But as for Kirby's lustrous flow, he may have difficulty maintaining his glorious locks behind bars since access to product is limited for detainees. Yeah, this 18-year-old, first of all, I can't even tell you how disgusted I am that he has two counts of attempted murder, narcotics possession, possession of a weapon during a violent crime, and he's out on $55,000 bail.
Jeez.
But we're going to forgive him to a degree, Tim. We have to, because what kind of animals would we be? I'm going to send you his picture right now, Tim.
Okay.
To not just think, oh, you know, yes, he's a horrible human being, but look how beautiful he is, Tim. You know what this reminds me of? Did you see the picture?
Yeah, I have.
His hair is fabulous. I will tell you, I'm jealous of it. Mm-hmm. This reminds me of that, what was it, the teardrop guy from like about 7, 8, 9 years ago, the criminal who was busted for something heinous, but he was really good looking and had piercing blue eyes and a little tattoo of a teardrop on his cheek.
Yeah. You know, when I look at it, you know what I see? Speaking of who we just spoke about, it looks like Prince's first album.
Oh yeah. I can see that. Yeah. Yeah. The guy's shirtless and has gorgeous long hair. And like that becomes the main focus of the story again. So that's dumb crime, stupid criminals, dumb reporting. Stupid reporters. But I guess I just reported on it, so that puts me in it as well.
There,
I can't win, Tim. I cannot win. Galveston lawyer has been stopped, cited after a very scary stroll on a seawall beach, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Are you ready for this?
Okay.
Dun 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 dun. Dun, 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 dun. Police stopped a Galveston man dressed up as a horror movie character Michael Myers on a storm-swept beach Monday after someone called 911 about the creepy sight. Police received a call about a man walking the beach while carrying what looked to be a bloody knife. Department spokesperson Sergeant Stacy Pepion said, responding officers stopped the man and put him in handcuffs. That's when they found the knife and the blood were fake, Papillon said. Who was the masked man? According to Facebook, it was an island attorney, Mark Metzger. Metzger, earlier Monday, posted pictures of himself dressed as Michael Myers, the serial killer from the Halloween movie franchise. Metzger wrote he was pranking Galveston by wearing the getup and posted a picture of himself standing near the historic Galveston Island Pleasure Pier. Social media posts circulated of Metzger walking on the beach and of him being handcuffed by the police, Metzger was cited for disorderly conduct and released, Papillon said. In a second post made around 7:20 p.m., Metzger wrote about his appearance on the beach, about just bringing positive vibes to the gloom and doom out there, generating some laughter, helping people crack a smile, and restoring our faith in humanity through humor. Uh-huh. I guess his version of humor and lightening things up during a storm dressed as a killer carrying a large bloody knife has a different feel to the people of Galveston.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the storm was scary enough. You don't need to pile on. Yeah.
So if taking a silly walk down the beach during a storm in a costume and subsequently being arrested for disorderly conduct accomplished any of that, then I'll do it again all day, every day, Metzger wrote. He sounds like he belongs with our law firm, Tim. He acknowledged the misdemeanor charge, but said he was still fuzzy about what was illegal about his actions. I do understand that. I mean, what exactly was illegal, unless there is a strict law about wearing masks? And if people are, you know, wearing masks in Galveston, you know, I've gone into Cub Foods and worn my C95 or N95 mask. And have seen people wear Chewbacca masks, Darth Vader masks, and other masks while in the store. I don't know if it's a finger up to the society or just trying to have fun. But, I guess I don't know what the actual crime would be.
Not in the middle of a disaster area, though, Dave. You know, in the middle of a storm zone when things are going on. I guess, but I still
don't know what the law would be on. That'd be interesting. Well, maybe we'll follow this case. I'm not willing to step up as his defense attorney at this point.
I wouldn't.
Although if I was him, I would have said I was just preparing to shoot a commercial. Let me slay your prosecution this season. You know, if you're pulled over for DUI, I'll kill that crime immediately. Right. That would have been
God.
That would have been my attempt to try to turn it around. But yeah, I don't know that dressed as a murdering serial killer from a horror franchise is a way to spread levity and love in your community. But Tim, that's not the only idiot lawyer out there right now.
Oh, do tell.
A South Carolina lawyer enlisted a hitman for $10 million life insurance policy, according to the attorney. South Carolina lawyer Alex Murdaugh. Not Metzger, like our final one, but mm-hmm. Alex Murdaugh arranged for another man to kill him earlier this month so that his son could collect on a $10 million life insurance policy, authorities said Tuesday. Wasn't this the setup for the movie Fletch? If I remember correctly, it was an attorney trying to have himself killed for the money and was setting Fletch up as the fall guy on this. Murdaugh, 53, survived the September 4th shooting, which happened months after the unsolved slayings of his wife and adult son. Police say that Murdaugh told 911 that he was shot in the head while changing a flat tire and that the shooting caused only a superficial wound. His attorney, Richard Harpootlian, I don't know, H-A-R-P-O-O-T-L-I-A-N, Harpootlian, told NBC's Today Show on Wednesday that his client was trying to get off opiates he was taking to get over his death of his son and wife. Is that what you take opiates for? I thought that was for pain.
It's like supposed to be, yeah.
Physical pain, not mental anguish.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was trying to get over opiates because he'd become depressed over the slaying of his wife and son. Believing his insurance policy had a suicide clause, Murdaugh enlisted a man to kill him during fake car breakdown, according to the attorney. The scheme was an attempt on his part to do something to protect his child, Harpootlian said. In a written statement, Harpootlian said Jim Griffin, another attorney for Murdaugh, said it had become clear Alex believed that ending his life was his only option. Today, he knows that's not true. For the last 20 years, there have been many people feeding his addiction to opioids. During that time, these individuals took advantage of his addiction and his ability to pay substantial funds for illegal drugs, the statement said. One of those individuals took advantage of his mental illness and agreed to take Alex's life by shooting him in the head. On Tuesday, Curtis Edward Smith, age 61, was arrested on charges of assisted suicide, assault and battery of a high aggravated nature, pointing and presenting a firearm, insurance fraud, and conspiracy to commit insurance fraud, according to the South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division, or SLED. That's an unfortunate
anagram. If you've been following this case, this guy is, I mean, they're saying that they're probably could make another Making of a Murderer series based on this guy.
Really?
Yeah, because he's suspected of killing his wife and son. And not only that, but a housekeeper went missing and then later turned up dead.
Holy cow.
And yeah, a few years back, and they're saying that he's probably responsible for that killing as well, allegedly. So, yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that whole Murdaugh case down there in South Carolina.
Here, Alex Murdaugh's father, family patriarch Randolph Murdaugh III, died at 81 just days after Paul and Margaret were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, there's a lot going on in this story.
There's a lot to unpack there. In fact, one well-known legal authority went on TMZ and said, this is the kind of case you would see in Florida, not in South Carolina. I don't make those words up. That's exactly what they said.
But isn't South Carolina the Florida of North Carolina?
Well, you would think. Yeah.
Wow, what a crazy-ass story.
It is. It's bizarre. And in fact, the idea was he was going to have himself killed so he could give the $10 million insurance policy off to his next of kin.
Surviving son, yeah.
Yeah. So it's normally you hire somebody to kill somebody else, not yourself. It's I think he probably knew that the heat was a little too close and he probably had to bail.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, it's bad enough when attorneys go bad, but how about Batman?
Batman?
A man named Tatman was wearing a Batman shirt when he was arrested for Robin, according to records, Tim.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alan Tatman, 46, was busted Wednesday for allegedly pilfering merchandise worth more than $500 from a Target store in Lexington, Kentucky. When he posed for his mugshot, Tatman was wearing a black t-shirt with the Batman logo. Tatman, who is on probation for a prior felony conviction, is being held in the county jail on theft charges, as well as counts related to his alleged failure to appear in court in connection with a separate burglary and theft case. So Tat Batman in jail, Tim.
Thank God.
here's commitment to your spouse, buddy. An Indiana woman trying to pick up her husband after he drunkenly hit a semi ended up totaling both their vehicles when she arrived, police said. The 56-year-old husband had veered across the center line of State Road 165 in Posey County on Monday night and collided with a semi-truck, according to Indiana State Police. When the couple's home, just a short drive away, the husband called his wife to get him before troopers and sheriff's deputies arrived, police said. But as she drove to the scene of the crash, the wife slammed into the husband's truck, still stopped on the roadway, police said. Police said the couple showed signs of impairment after they arrived at the scene. The wife had a blood alcohol concentration of 0.22%.
Ooh.
22% in a preliminary test at the hospital. Her husband's test was 0.28%.
Jeez.
The woman was arrested, taken to jail, while her husband was admitted to the hospital with a medical issue not considered by police to be life-threatening. Thankfully, the semi-driver wasn't injured. Holy cow. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go pick up my drunk spouse while drunk. That's commitment to a relationship there, son.
That's something.
coupons, Tim. Who hasn't tried to use some coupons to save a few dollars?
I think we all have.
Yeah. Got a little too irritating to me spending days clipping coupons and checking online, and I've realized how much time I've wasted is probably worth much more than the money I've saved in clipping coupons. Mm-hmm. But a Virginia Beach woman is going to prison for 12 years in a massive couponing scam. Lori Ann Talons designed counterfeit coupons at home, complete with product photos and working barcodes, the Virginian Pilot reports, because coupons are so widely distributed and thus don't each have unique barcodes. They're hard to track, per NBC News. Her husband, Pacifico Talens, who also been convicted and sentenced for his role, which was mainly distributing the fakes, the coupons offered steep discounts, sometimes for more than the value of the item, so that shoppers got money back when buying these items. Lori is going in for 12 years. Pacifico will serve 7 years. They're out on bond for a few weeks while they arrange care for their kids. However, they do have a get out of jail coupon, Tim. I wonder if they'll try to use that.
Oh, God.
Lorianne Talons started selling the coupons in 2017 through a network recruited in a coupon clipper Facebook group. using the name Master Chef, earning about $400,000, costing manufacturers about $31 million. She sent the coupons out by mail, accepting payment via PayPal or Bitcoin. The New York Times reports one of the coupon enthusiasts recruited in the scam figured out how it worked and reported everything to the Coupon Information Center. That's why we can't have nice things, Tim, because somebody's got to be the coupon cop. Somebody's got to call it in. Once Talens was caught last year, she fessed up to everything and sat down with investigators to explain how her racket worked and how coupon scams around the country are run per the pilot. See, another reason to be careful. You think you're saving money, you find an online coupon, boom, you're doing time, Tim.
Well, now I think the coupon mafia is going to be after her because she's a coupon snitch.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of Bitcoin, a county employee in New York State is accused of stealing from the job, but with an oh-so-modern twist, Tim. Authorities in Suffolk County say IT supervisor Christopher Naples mined cryptocurrency on the job and ran up at least $6,000 in electric bills in the process, reporting the New York Times. Mining cryptocurrency, typically Bitcoin, requires heavy lifting from computers tasked with solving complex equations, per the AP. Prosecutors say the 42-year-old Naples used no fewer than 46 devices hidden throughout the county center in Riverhead, with some even tucked under floorboards. The devices belonged to Naples, but they ran on county's dime, say authorities. We're talking about an enormous amount of energy, says Suffolk County District Attorney Timothy D. Sini. He says the estimate of $6,000 in utility bills is on the low side because that reflects usage of only the first 10 devices discovered. They had been humming since February. Naples is charged with public corruption, grand larceny, and computer trespass, and he faces up to 15 years in prison if convicted. If not clear how much, if any, cryptocurrency he managed to collect before his arrest.
Hmm.
Your Honor, Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, I will have you know that what was going on was truly Christopher Naples' way of trying to help the community. He knew that this seemed like an illogical, crazy scheme that would never pass through his management, but he wanted to do something to give back to the community. So he used these community services in order to mine Bitcoin to help pay off community debt, Your Honor, to help. And he wasn't going to tell that up front because he didn't want people to think that, you know, his selfless nature was all about charity, because he knew that the town itself would be too prideful to take that money, Your Honor. So in putting this good man in jail and punishing him, Your Honor, all we're doing is helping a man who wanted to help his community. Sure, he ran up over $6,000 in electric bills, but let's tally the amount that Bitcoin raised. We're up over $6,100, Your Honor, and he can pay that using that service. Now, the rest of the money that's gleaned is simply pure profit that will only help the community. Your Honor, I ask that we throw this case out on the case that this is just somebody who cared just a little too much, Your Honor. I rest my case.
Does it hurt?
What? Does what hurt?
Does it hurt when you reach that far?
Wow. That's painful, Tim. Painful. I'll have you know that I have based my summations and court proceedings on, only the best, including Jeff Winger from TV's Community, who also did not have a law degree. But that's beyond the point. All right. We're here, Tim. Uh-huh. We're here truly at the point of no return. The final two stories are here. And there's no going back if you stick with us. If you leave and ditch out now, I forgive you. But let's face it, like seeing a picture of Prince dead, you know you're going to hang in for these last two stories. For those of you that want out, I understand. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio, True Crime Tuesday. For those of you willing to hang in, here's your payout. Here's the headline from USA Today, Tim, from September 14th, 2021. Truly horrific. Man gets 10 years for stabbing a woman with a semen-filled syringe.
Ew.
A man was sentenced to 10 years in prison after prosecutors say he stabbed a woman with a syringe filled with semen at a Maryland grocery store. This guy missed a few classes, Tim, in health. I don't think he realizes this is not how you inject semen into a woman to make her pregnant. That's not how it works.
Okay, but Dave, let's give him credit. He had incredible aim to get all of it into that good little syringe.
Yeah. Well, it could be because his name is Thomas Steeman.
Oh.
The Seaman Bandit, 52 years old. He was sentenced in Anne Arundel County Circuit Court on Tuesday on charges of first and second degree assault in the February 2020 incident at a supermarket in Churchton, Maryland. First and second degree. Boy, I can only do it once. This guy was able to manage it twice. Wow. He entered an Alford plea, meaning he pled guilty without admitting to committing the crime, and his jail time will be followed by 5 years probation. The defendant's actions are truly horrific, she said. He intentionally went out into our community with the goal of assaulting an unsuspecting woman. In February 2020, a female shopper reported she'd been assaulted while returning her cart in a grocery store parking lot, according to the statement. Surveillance video showed Steeman with his semen following the woman into the store's cart area and taking something out of his pocket before bumping into her. The woman backs out of the store and he continues to follow her. The woman told police she asked him if she had been burned with a cigarette, and the suspect replied, "Yeah, it felt like a bee sting, didn't it?" Later, the woman said she discovered a small red puncture wound. The wound started to swell the next day, and she sought medical treatment. After Anne Arundel County police released the video and asked the public for information, they received a tip that led them to Steeman. Steeman the Seaman, Tim. He was arrested days later, and officials found the clothes worn during the attack and additional syringes in his car. Good Lord. Days after Steeman's arrest, the liquid inside matched his DNA. Well, that's good. At least he's not out milking others for this crime. Good God. Steeman was also seen on surveillance video lunging at two other women, including a 17-year-old girl. According to prosecutors, Steeman is being held at the Jennifer Road Detention Center, according to jail records. Good God.
That's a special kind of effed up right there.
That's all kinds of crazy. But you know what? It makes this next one seem... Well, it makes his crime almost seem tame. I'm going to say almost seem tame because obviously I don't think that stabbing a woman with a needle full of semen is something that should be overlooked. And, no. But this one will just make your stomach roll. Are you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
This is, people are so gross and filthy, Tim. They're dirty, dirty, filthy pigs. I don't like going into public anymore. I don't like being at public locations. If people offer me drinks or food at locations, I don't take it because of stories like this, Tim.
Okay.
Cops have identified a man who defecated inside a freezer case at an Oklahoma supermarket. A vile act that was discovered after an unfortunate shopper placed her hand in the waste while reaching for a bag of Totino's pizza rolls. According to investigators, a suspect opened a freezer door and relieved himself Sunday inside a Crest Foods market in Moore, Oklahoma City suburb. The suspect is in his 20s wearing an Oklahoma City Thunder jacket or hoodie. Police say a person of interest in the September 12th supermarket poop incident has been taken into custody in connection with a separate matter. A police spokesperson told TSG that that's the smoking gun where I got this story, that the man's name will be released upon conclusion of the investigation and formal filing of charges by the district attorney's office. Shirley Wright Johnson, a Moore resident, was shopping with her two daughters when she reached into a freezer for a bag of pizza rolls. Upon picking up the item, Wright Johnson realized that she had poop on her hand.
Oh.
Yeah, the suspect apparently defecated on a bag of Totino's pizza rolls. You know, there's other ways to let Totino's know you don't care for their food. send a heated text. Maybe tweet about it.
Yeah, tweet.
Yeah, but don't literally shit on their product by shitting on their product. Oh. And the police say the store camera recorded a very decent video of the incident, which is good to know.
Oh, good.
In a video Wright Johnson shot inside the supermarket, she recorded images of the stained merchandise and exclaimed, "I pick up a bag of pizza rolls and there's literally shit on it." She added, "Human shit, excuse my language." You should have thought of that before you gave that quote that I had to read.
Right.
But this is why people are gross. You go into, you know, like you go in and there's delicious, delicious donuts just there. And you can lift that little glass door and reach in, Tim. You don't know whose dirty, filthy hands have been reaching in there. And they're like, oh, use a tissue. How often do you see people grab a tissue and reach in and bump other donuts with their dirty poo-covered knuckles? And then I just go in there wanting a Long John, cream-filled, if you don't mind. And boom, all of a sudden, I'm eating people's, you know, poop. I don't do it. I can't do it. So gross.
Well,
people are so gross.
I used to use the tissue before you just described that. Now I don't think I'll ever eat another donut again. Thank you.
No. Unless you're at like Dunkin' and you see them with their gloves on, reaching in, taking the donuts out, putting them in the box for you. I can't do it anymore. I'm so grossed out by how people are disgusting. Disgusting, disgusting pigs. I watch people walk out of bathrooms without washing their hands after shitting.
Yeah.
And that should be a crime right there. I'd like to do citizens' arrests, knock them to the floor, and hold them until police can come. Not with my hands, but maybe a small child so that I don't have to get poop on me. I'll just push that child on top of the perpetrator or the poopetrator and make them wait until police arrive. But then I watch them go out and manhandle their food or start digging into the chips and cheese on their table with reckless abandon.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so gross. Well, I'm not disgusting. I don't get poop on my hand. Baloney. Baloney.
Yeah.
People are gross. Blech. Blech.
Yeah.
That's all I want to say, Tim. B-L-E-C-H. Blech. I'm going to become one of those crazy old hermits who just doesn't leave my home for fear that I'll be eaten by something or poked with a dirty stick or eat something that somebody's poop-infested hands have touched.
You're going to be Howard Hughes using tissue boxes for shoes with long hair and nails too long to wipe yourself with.
I'm alone in my hotel room way too often, Tim. And I tried the old, tissue boxes for slippers, and they are conveniently comfortable. And the tissue absorbs the bottom of my feet sweat. So I kind of like it.
I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm alone way too often here, Tim. Way too often. People email me, dave@darknessradio.com. Share your dumb crimes and stupid criminal stories if you've got them. And I know you've got them in your town. But let's stay away from dead celebrity pictures and stories of people pooping on Totino's pizza rolls.
Yeah.
I will agree, they're not always the best. But still, come on. Seriously? So gross.
Yeah.
People are sick.
Yeah.
You know? Sick. Sick, sick, sick. That's it for this week, kids. Thanks for hanging in. You did it. You saved it. You made it all the way through with us. We appreciate it. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the Pooptacular that is True Crime Tuesday.